Welcome to the Wade for Wireless show, and this is Wade with wadeforwireless.com. Okay, I know, sappy beginning, but I thought I'd mix it up a little bit. So today, I want to ask you, who is at fault? Who will pay? And the reason I want to put it like that is because I had a chance to have a conversation with Rob Turner, who's a super nice guy. Rob Turner is a partner with 360 Venture Law out of Atlanta. So what I wanted to do was just, I wanted to discuss some questions we had, and I would have loved to have him on the show here, but I got to be honest with you, I've been so busy. I mean, we started this like 3 weeks ago, and it's just, I just been busy with a lot of stuff, and October is not going to be that much better. You know how it is. You get busy with things. But anyway, the reason I'm talking to you is because I just thought you guys would appreciate going over different problems you see in the field, especially after the installation. And let's say the landlord's not happy, there's a zoning issue, it fails an inspection. These are all problems that we see. Or you get a fine for doing something that you thought you shouldn't get a fine for. I didn't cover traffic control. That's usually where a lot of the fines come in. But first, I want to thank Tower Safety for sponsoring my blog. Tower Safety, based in Phoenix, Arizona, but you don't have to go to them because they will go to you to train your people for tower rescue, for tower training, for OSHA and CPR and first aid. They'll do all that for you. Why is that important? You have to have a company that stays on top of things, because with the NWSA coming out with the new changes, especially the way tie wrap's going and everything, you need someone who is on top of the training, because you still need the tower rescue part of it. You still need OSHA. What Nate's doing with NWSA, they're going to put standards on where you can be with what you can do at the tower based on the NWSA certification. Plus, you have to prepare for the NWSA certification because you have to go to a testing center to get it. So you want someone who's on top of that. And Tower Safety, towersafety.com, is on top of that. And you can call them at 480-313-0678. Again, 480-313-0678. Based in Phoenix, and they're going to have drone closeout training coming up in December. Let's go on. Who's at fault? Who's going to pay? I'm going to tell you right now. I had a dozen questions that I ran by Rob. Super great guy, by the way. Really nice guy. I like all these guys, I got to tell you. I haven't met too many bad people here lately, which is great. But it's always something that we have questions about. The pain point is that when you're out there at the site, you get everything done, somebody complains, the landlord's mad at you, the installer, because it's your fault. And it's usually the guy that's at the site, right? He's not called. Well, he may call your boss. That could happen. He may call your boss if you have a leasing partner, a site acquisition partner, site acquisition person. They may call them and talk to them. If it's the customer you're working for, they may call the customer and complain, and then the customer will call you. By customer, I mean if you're doing work for, say, you know, a carrier, they may call the carrier and they may whine and moan, and then the carrier is going to call you and say, what are you doing out there? Or it'll filter down to the local guy who's going to come out and yell at you, the project manager, construction manager, whatever. But anyway, let's get into the questions. I got a dozen questions. This may take a while because I'm going to try to really read the answers, because I want to be very specific in what Rob's answer was here. So I asked, first thing was very basic. When looking at a building, how do I find out who owns and manages a site? Because who owns a building may not manage it, right? From what Rob said, his answer, beyond the direct inquiry of the front desk security officer, if the building has one, a helpful starting point is the county tax assessor's office. Typically, you can search your property owner records with the assessor's office. Once you determine the owner, then you can contact them for an introductory discussion, which may lead you to any property manager who's retained by the owner. I think you can do the same with tower sites, by the way. I think you can figure it out that way. Usually a tower site, they'll have a sign out there, but if they don't, start with the tax assessor's office. Good answer. Number two, when planning to mount on the roof, do I still need to go through zoning and permitting? I know, basic question, but here's his answer. The answer assumes that the location has been leased from the property owner and that it was confirmed that the local zoning allows communication antennas on rooftops prior to the lease. Prior to any construction and or installation, the tenant will need to, one, confirm with the local ordinance whether adding building permits or whether additional building permits are required for the antenna installation, most likely, and two, review the lease agreement to determine what types of consents, etc., may be needed from the landlord. Note, even if consent not required by the lease. From a liability protection standpoint, the tenant is strongly encouraged to obtain the landlord's written consent to do the work. So, number three, if I want to mount my small cell on a wall, say 10 foot above the ground, would the person that managed the roof be the contact? In other words, would the roof manager also manage a mounting on the lower parts of the building? Answer. Always start with the underlying site lease agreement to determine what the leased premises are and the extent of your permitted use. In other words, if you mount it in the roof, you couldn't just mount in the 10 foot down on the wall anyway. You'd have to get permission. That's the way I read it. So on with the answer. Basically, what space can you use on the property to locate your antenna and equipment? The lease will also indicate who the appropriate contact persons are for any property-related questions. For the question above, the person that manages a roof is probably also responsible for managing the overall exterior of the building. But again, you have to make sure. Question number four. If I decide to mount my radio head in a stairway window, who would help me coordinate the mounting? And I can speak today. The answer would be the property owner, property manager contact should be your starting point. This is important because in addition to the coordinating the actual on-site work, there is a need for this type of mounting to occur after There may be a need for this type of mounting to occur after normal business hours. So you want to avoid disturbing the other tenants in the building. That's why they say that. As noted in other comments above, the carrier should always confirm in its lease whether the landlord's consent is required before completing any such work, especially that involves drilling into the building's exterior. Very important. Keep that in mind. If someone has to core drill through a floor and followed the drawings but caused the tenant problems, who's at fault? Now, this is a big one, people, because sometimes the installer does everything that they're supposed to do and there's still problems. I don't know. Anyone who's ever done an installation has probably run into this at some point. So for this, the answer is, for this scenario, and in all likelihood, the party that completed the drilling is going to have some level of responsibility. You hear that? You're at fault. Whether you're at fault or not, you're going to have to make corrections to whatever it is. Virtually all communications infrastructure lease agreements include indemnity provisions. A lease indemnity is where the tenant agrees to pay the landlord for any costs, expenses, damages suffered by the landlord from the tenant's actions. Now, in this case, you would be the tenant. In this scenario, whether the core drilling was conducted by the tenant or one of its subcontractors, they can certainly expect the landlord to ask them to pay for any damages they cause to other tenants in the building. So just keep that in mind. I don't want to say you're at fault, but if there's a problem, even if you did everything right, and you know, most landlords are probably going to be reasonable with you, or at least the managers. But if something goes wrong, especially when you're core drilling, you're going to wind up paying to fix it, even if it's just free labor. Maybe the landlord can help you with the other stuff, but usually you work together. Because I've done a lot of building installs. Most site managers or the building engineer, they're very reasonable. I mean, not all of them are. I mean, you always got your prick out there. You want to smack in the face or poke in the eye. But the reality is most of these guys are willing to work with you. And that's what I've seen. Most people are generally good people. You just can't piss them off, for lack of a better word. When you start banging heads together, that doesn't help anything. So the one thing I've learned through these, and this is my opinion now, when you are working with these people, just be open-minded, be reasonable, and ask for forgiveness. You know, even if you said, I did everything right, I'm sorry, something went wrong. Could you tell me what it was? May or may not be an admission of guilt, however they take it. But most times, if you just come to them a little humble, they're willing to meet you halfway because you're going to pay something, right? If you come to them and said, you gave me this and your instructions suck. If you confront them like that, I would say it's going to end badly. In this case, the reason I ask about this is because installation problems happen all the time. And this is something that people just have to deal with. And if you can deal with it with the manager, or if there's a building engineer, a lot of times there's an engineer on site, like a building engineer or manager, and you can work with them. And they're really easy to work with. Now, there are exceptions. If there's a hole in the roof that causes a leak or water damage, that's a problem. I'm just going to tell you right now, people don't like leaks in roofs, especially a lot of these guys, for whatever reason, they have these soft rubber roofs with no rocks on it. In my experience, that's been a problem. You have to be real careful with that. And a lot of times they put down plywood or they give you something to walk on, which is the best thing that they can do because, I mean, things happen. So to me, that is a key question. Okay, next one. Number six, if after the installation is completed and the equipment's fans are very noisy in a building or in a street pole, what would happen if nearby people complain? On a street, it may be someone's home. In a building, it may be a tenant. What would happen when the people complain? Who would be held responsible for this resolution? The reason I ask this question is because you wouldn't believe how many people ask me this question. In a building, the tenant just complains to the landlord. It's usually straightforward. In a street, people don't know who to complain to. They're looking for the sign. If it's a, you know, an AT&T, a Verizon, a Sprint, a T-Mobile site, they may call them to complain. But till you get through to the numbers they give are, maybe they have a knock number on there. Maybe they don't. Maybe it just has the little Verizon logo on there. But the problem is when these people have problems, if it's near somebody's house, and I don't know, some of these sites have noisy, noisy fans. You guys know that, especially the older sites. The newer sites are quieting everything down. Plus, fans, I know I'm getting off track here, but fans really are a common point of failure, and they actually cause a lot of problems. You know, they pull dust in, or you get dirt in there, the fan fails, it overheats. So they're coming up with new and creative ways for that. But that's why I asked this question. I get asked this all the time. And all you can really do is complain to the carrier that I've seen on a street. Or if you're in a building, you can complain to the landlord. In a building, things tend to get done quicker. People make you figure out how to soundproof a wall, soundproof a room, or quiet your fans. Things get resolved quicker in a building that I've seen than out on a street pole. In a street pole, most people don't care, except you got to think about the town. Like, for instance, San Diego, La Jolla. If you mount something in La Jolla in San Diego and you have fan noise, you're out of there. The town's not going to put up with it. They're going to make you do something about it immediately. Now, if you're like in LA, town may not care. They could care less, especially if they're getting rent for the pole. They're going to go to the guy that's paying them. And that's California. That's the same state. I've seen the same thing in New York. In New York City, depending upon what borough you're in, like if you're in Manhattan and you're making a lot of noise, someone's coming down on you. If you're in Brooklyn and making a lot of noise, depending upon where you are in Brooklyn, chances are nobody cares. Just deal with it. It's just one more thing in the street. So there you got the opposite coasts, and they each have similar issues. I'll repeat the question because I got so off track. Sorry. If after the installation is completed and the equipment's fans are very noisy in a building or in a street pole, what would happen if the nearby people complain? That's the gist of it. Rob's answer is, guidance for resolving this type of scenario will come from the site lease agreement. If the equipment is located in a building and the fans are generating noise that impacts other tenants, this will be an issue for the landlord having to deal with its other tenants, but likely one for the communication company as well, because most leases have non-interference language in them, especially if these guys have been doing it a while. If we look to a street pole, for example, and nearby neighbors are complaining, the communication company will need to confirm that they met all the appropriate permits, etc., for their installation and operation. Presuming that they are properly permitted, they will need to factor in the potential impact on their goodwill in the community by not taking action to mitigate the sound. Just like many matters in real estate, this is a site-specific question. So notice the goodwill statement in there. If the carrier comes out and let's say the fans are open, the vents are open, and then maybe they put that foam in to try to soften the noise, or they insulate the cabinet to try to quiet the noise down. They do everything. They can't get rid of the fan, right? Because the site will overheat. That's probably the one thing that they can do. They can say, well, we tried. We made an effort. And that's probably the goodwill factor. But I think most cities or towns are going to have to remember to put that goodwill factor in there. And it's really going to make a difference. Next question, number seven. There needs to be a new utility like power backhaul that is located on that is needed on the roof of a building. Should that be negotiated in the lease prior to the installation with the landlord? Now, the reason I ask this is because this is a common problem. Sometimes you need more power. Sometimes you need more backhaul. And when you need more of any utility, it can become an issue because you don't own the building. So you're not out in the street. If you're in a building, you're on the roof. The power probably comes in the basement. Anyway, so Rob's answer is, the scenario is a common point of contention for carriers and landlords. Landlords want absolute control over their property structures, while the tenant wants to ensure that it can construct and operate its antenna and equipment for the duration of the lease term without having to always ask the landlord for permission. Most leases will contain a broad maintenance and upgrades provision that will provide the tenants flexibility for ensuring that their antenna and their equipment are current over the lease term, depending on how the lease agreement establishes utility rights within the building. In other words, through a dedicated conduit or risers, etc. And if the tenant requires additional space within the building to run utilities to the antenna and equipment, coordination with the landlord will be required. Note, if the tenant believes a landlord consent is required, that has the potential to be a long lead item. So you know what long lead items mean? That means more time, more wasted time just to get something installed. But you know what? I'm going to be honest with you. I think in today's world, we just expect that. You just expect to wait. You expect to figure out how you're going to solve it. You expect to do the engineering. You're not going to just pop in another break or whatever. You're actually going to have to do a little more work than that. And I think depending upon the work, you know, we may try to sneak in another outlet, another break or something like that. But we also understand you're probably going to have to get it inspected again, whether it's by the landlord's engineer or whether you have to bring an electrical inspector in. For fiber, maybe you do, maybe you don't. I don't know what the local issues are. Not everybody inspects fiber or copper backhaul installations. It's just one of those things. If you're putting in a wireless link, you know, that's probably in the lease to how many antennas, outdoor units, and links you can run and how you're going to run it back let's say in your closet or your shelter, whatever's there. Okay. Number 8, when choosing a pole to mount one in a city street, how is the lease handled? I brought this up because people ask this all the time for on both sides. So under this scenario, under this scenario, the carrier would first have to determine who owns the pole. Assuming the pole is owned by a utility provider, the tenant is going to have to provide a lease agreement with the city's utility provider for the actual space on the pole. Note, there are a number of other variables to address with pole-mounted antennas, including power to the mounted equipment and ensuring fiber access. That is so true. And the other thing is permitting and zoning. If you're in a city, they're going to have strict permitting and zoning rules about how it looks, how it sounds, and things like that. So there's a lot of issues here, right? When we had small cells, we thought small cells would be the be-all, end-all because you go out and you slap it up on a pole. It's not that easy. We did that with Wi-Fi because Wi-Fi had mesh. We could do wireless backhaul, and then we could just, you know, every 5 or 10, which mesh was a whole thing in itself because it sucked down the bandwidth using mesh, which is why I'm not a huge fan of UE backhaul. I'm sorry, getting off track. But anyway, you're going to have to worry about where you're going to put the fiber, what kind of backhaul you're going to put in. Are you going to put a wireless backhaul in? And how's it going to look? Obviously, you can't put a 6 gig antenna on. And anyone who's in the U.S. that's done 6 gig links, you know that those antennas are, what's the smallest 6 gig antenna? Is it 8 foot or 10 foot? You're not going to do something like that. You're going to put something like a 5.8 gig antenna on, which is that tiny little small, easy backhaul, or you're going to do 60 gig or 70 gig E-band. You're going to have a quick link like that, and it's going to have to be short, sweet, and weather is going to be an issue. I know I'm getting off track here, and I'm getting out of the legalities into a technical issue, but small matters when going on a pole. Looks matter when going on a pole. It has to be attractive. It has to look good in a city. If you're out in a suburb or a smaller town, they may not care. I got to tell you, I look at some of these small towns. I'm going to give you an example. Like I go to York, Pennsylvania, and I see stuff hanging all over these poles. Nobody even put a thought into what it would look like. They just want it over 10 feet so nobody messes with it. Now, with that said, some stuff looks good, some doesn't. I don't know what to tell you. Anyway, so getting off track. I just wanted you guys to know that when you mount on a pole, it's not all peaches and cream. You have a lot to consider when you're mounting on a pole. Number 9, for poles, if fiber is on one side of the street, not the other, how hard is it to change an asset with utility or city-owned poles? In other words, does one entity generally own all the poles? So I asked this question because everyone wonders this. It hasn't done it. Now, all you site acquisition people, you've probably done this. This is old hat. You already know how to deal with it. You already know that, you know, you read the fiber map first, then you pick the assets. So Rob's answer was, within a given municipality, one or more utilities may control most or all of the poles. As such, a prospective tenant will need to coordinate its potential use with the appropriate utility operator. Speaking to the question on changing from one side to the other side of the street, this is where the tenant should put a lot of time and effort into its pre-lease due diligence to determine where the underground utilities are located on the sides of a given road. This information will no doubt help guide the potential tenant of which poles will best serve its needs. Okay, that was the answer. That's the answer I was looking for. Plan ahead. When we're doing this, you have a lot of issues that with planning that can eliminate a lot of problems down the line. For instance, with the RF design, they're going to pick out poles that they think are best, especially for small cell or C-RAN or ODAS. And I'm talking outdoors here. Indoor is a different game, right? With indoor, you're going to go to a closet, a telco closet, or a basement, or wherever your fiber, backhaul, whatever comes in. And that's going to be your demarcation for the backhaul. Then you're just going to run stuff throughout the building. Different buildings, different issues. You have a stadium. They probably have multiple rooms in a stadium because it's such a large structure. Train stations, similar thing. You know, they probably have multiple telecom rooms. But anyways, outside, when you're mounting on these poles, you should have your fiber map there. RF's going to pick these poles, and you have to be flexible on which side of the street you go on, because it's just going to make your life a whole lot easier if you have the fiber, if you're doing fiber. If you have the fiber map first, and you can actually look at where you can mount. The other thing is, like the 100th thing, is that you want to look at backhaul options. Does a cable company have connections there? When we were doing the early small cell deployments and trying to drive the cost down, we looked at fiber because that's how a lot of this stuff was connected with fiber. We tried to look at cable connections and work with cable companies, and some cable companies are excited about that. But even these cable companies can't connect on every pole. You have to be very clear about where they can and cannot connect and what neighborhoods they're in. You know, you think as a cable company owns one area that they have that whole area, they're on every pole, and they're just not. You have to know that ahead of time. If you're going to do wireless backhaul, which I'm a big fan of wireless, you have to make sure you have line of sight, or you can shoot down the street to one or the other. Or if you're doing near line of sight or no line of sight, you'd better make sure you don't have too much interference in that particular area. So it's to me, these are all issues you have to think about up front. Just something to think about. Number 10, if fiber is needed, who decides if it has to be run overhead or underground? This is a common question too, but one I was curious about. The answer is from Rob. The fiber question will be determined in part by the utility easements on either side of a particular road, the particular company that will run the fiber, and what types of municipal permits are required for the work, and how long it takes to obtain the permits. The companies that install the fiber have to address all those factors, along with the carrier's needs. How many access points along that particular route to determine whether to locate the fiber underground or overhead? Okay, number 11. If the installer mounts a small cell on the wall as per the landlord's specifications and there are problems, who is at fault? Now, the answer is the scenario will be fact dependent on what happened and any damages that arose from the event. Even though the carrier followed the landlord's specs, if the carrier was negligent with installation, it could be the fault and the potential liable to the landlords and the landlord's other tenants. See the comments above regarding indemnity for some perspective. Let me read that again. Even though the carrier followed the landlord's specs, if the carrier was negligent with its installation, it could be the fault and the potential liability. The carrier could be at fault, okay? That's what I'm trying to say. I'm just having a hard time reading it. The carrier could be at fault, and he's going to be liable to the landlord and the tenant. The guy doing the installation is probably at fault and could be liable to the landlord and the tenant. That's what I'm trying to say. I know I just can't read the question or read the answer very well. When you're doing the installation like that, you're going to be to blame. They're going to point everything at you. So there you are. They beat you down on price, and now they're saying you got to pay for these problems after you followed their instructions clearly and coherently. That's what I'm saying with this issue, and that's why I asked that question, to make you understand there is a liability there, one that you may be responsible for. That's what I was trying to say. Trust me, installation. Everyone thinks it's easy. You know, they think, I used to do TV repair and now I'm out. Which TV repair is hard, by the way. I admire those guys, but now I'm out putting small cells in. It's not something that just anybody can do. I know it sounds easy. I know I've done tower work, but when you do tower work, you tend to be a little rough around the edges as far as installation goes. And if you do residential work, you'll know what I'm talking about. When you're doing residential work, oh my God, people complain about everything. Just think of a tenant of a building being the same way. They're just going to complain about everything. And then do your best to make it look pretty. And do your best not to, hit a line, hit a power line, hit a pipe, hit anything of damage. And I've been through a lot of that in installation. Okay, last question. Hopefully I can get through it here. Number 12. If there is a zoning issue after the fact, or if the municipality fails the installation, how should each party proceed? So as a general rule, virtually all leases are structured so that if there are subsequent changes in laws and regulations that impact or limit the ability to operate a tower or roof-mounted antenna, that the tenant can terminate the lease without liability to the landlord. So there you go. If you want to get out of the lease, you get out of it. If you have to find another site, you figure it out. But that's why these carriers get so frustrated with all the townships and municipalities changing zoning laws, because they do it all the time. And suddenly they're like, where someone, a big carrier had coverage, now they don't, because they had to move or they had to leave or a municipality wouldn't let them in. I see that quite a bit. It's a little more, it's not as common now, but it was. That's why the CTIA pressured the FCC to do something, and Congress, to do something about this, because all these little rules and everything were just driving the carriers down. Every township, every little place you go has their own permitting and zoning rules. It just got to be frustrating. They would deny it. They would drag it out in court for years. It was just very frustrating. And when I was out at IWCE last year, that was one of the speakers that spoke on the same track I did, mentioned that about all the problems they have. It's just one of the things that we make fun of site. We don't make fun of site acquisition people. We have high respect for them, but we do make fun of the carriers for taking so long to build some of this stuff out. And we all look to carrier, oh, your coverage sucks here. You know, you can't always blame them. They try to get in an area. They can't. And it's funny. And I see this a lot throughout the years, right? Here you have an area that doesn't want a cell tower, and not in my backyard, NIMBY. You've all heard of that. Or they don't want anything like that in there. And I get it. They don't like it. They don't like the looks of it. I think towers are awesome. I think every city should build a huge tower in the center of it because it would be an attraction. Did you ever hear of the Eiffel Tower? Or people saying they should rip that out? No. No, it's something everybody wants to look at. Anyway, I know, off track. But my point is, when these municipalities and townships say that they don't want the towers in the city, or they don't want the coverage, or they don't want anything that looks like an eyesore, obviously they have a different opinion of what's an eyesore and what isn't, but they also are the first ones to complain to the carriers about coverage. That's why these stealth sites and stealth mountings, and that's why on rooftops they have to paint the antennas and paint the cabling to match the building. And when you go in a historical district, coverage stinks because they don't want anything in there. And that's why when you read about it, like I read Inside Towers almost every day, they go to great lengths to put these stealth sites in. They spend a lot of money to put them in. And then, you know, it's one of those things that they spend all that money just for a site, just so people that probably complain the loudest have coverage. You know, they're trying to help. Plus, if you call 911 and your phone doesn't work, who hears about it? People complain to the carrier. You know, they don't look at a historical district and say, it's your fault. I mean, the carrier does, but no one listens to the carrier. And the carrier's not going to whine about it. They're just going to try to figure out how to solve the coverage issue. All right. I know it's a long one. I know. I apologize. I'm losing my voice here because it just took so long to get through. But if you want to know more about Rob Turner, he's a partner with a law firm, 360 Venture Law, based in Atlanta. And it was really nice of him to reach out to me, and we got to talk, and I really enjoy this, talking about, you know, the different rules. And if you guys have questions, my email's in there. I'll put a form in there. You can just give me some feedback. Just think about questions you might want me to ask next time. I know a couple of these guys now. They're all just great guys. Rob's a great guy. You know, it's fun to talk about this stuff, and I wish I could get someone on the air to interview him with me, but most guys don't like to talk to me. Well, I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean, nobody wants to be recorded, but a lot of these answers, you can tell he put a lot of thought and time into it, and I really appreciate it, and I really want to thank him for it. Hey, my book, if you're still listening, I know it's over a half hour. If you're still listening, my book should be released next week. Next week, meaning probably the second week in October, and I hope it does because I got a lot going on in October. It's just taking, I'm editing right now, for those of you that care, but it just takes a long time. All right, everyone. Be smart, be safe, pay attention. See ya.